Okay, welcome to the Central Region RAC. My name is Brock McMillan. I'm the chair, and I represent Sportsman. The first thing I think we're going to do is we're going to do introductions, and so we'll start here with Ben Lauder, and we'll come around this way.
Ben Lauder, public at large.
Scott Jensen, public at large.
Mike Christensen, public at large.
AJ Maurer, agriculture.
Ken Strong, sportsman's rep.
Eric Reed, BLM.
Joshua Leonard, sportsman's rep.
I'm Jason Vernon, regional supervisor for the Central Region.
Thank you. Would also like to recognize Carl Hurst from the Wildlife Board, who's in attendance tonight in the audience. The first thing we need is approval of the agenda. If there's no disagreement, we'll approve and move on. So Ken's going to
propose we accept the.
Okay, there's been a motion and a second. All in favor? Unanimous. The minutes were distributed to all of the RAC from the last meeting. I would consider a similar motion.
I'll make that motion.
Excellent. Ken?
Second.
Okay. Eric seconds. Any discussion? All in favor? Unanimous again. Next on the agenda then is a Wildlife Board update. So I had the pleasure of attending the last Wildlife Board meeting. And as you know, it discussed primarily the bobcat management plan and the cougar management plan. The bobcat management plan was moved to be approved as presented, and that passed. There were several motions that were considered for the cougar management plan. The first one was, let's see, that the cash remain at 25 permits rather than decrease as proposed by the division, and that passed. The second motion was that they move the book cliffs back to a harvest objective with the same permit numbers. That passed unanimously, so that's going back from a limited entry to a harvest objective. The third motion was to move the Southwest Manti to a split unit season and move the permit numbers to 18. If you remember, the division's recommendation was limited entry 15. Our RAC suggested split with 15. The board motion moved split with 18, and that passed on a vote of 3-2 at the Wildlife Board. It was passed to increase the number of permits on the Southeast Manti to 26, which is what the recommendation was. It was moved to increase the permit numbers on the West Ochre Stansbury, so the sheep unit, to 12 tags. That motion failed to get a second. It was moved to decrease the permit numbers on the east unit, so that would be the Ochre Mountains, from 8-7. That passed unanimously. And the rest of the recommendations were accepted as presented by the division. There were a few other minor things. They presented an audit of the auction of the expo and a few other things, but does anybody have anything to add to that report of the Wildlife Board? Okay, I'll turn the time over to Jason to present a regional update.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Have a few things to discuss, a few opportunities for the RAC members coming up this in the next couple of months to get out in the field with some of our staff. If you're not participating in the rifle deer hunt, the region always holds a check station. We have several check stations, Spanish Fork Canyon, usually I-15 south of Santa Quin, and in Nephi Canyon. And those usually run Saturdays and Sundays of the opening of the rifle hunt. Usually they'll be collecting harvest information as well as some CWD collection at those stations as well. So if any of the RAC members are interested in attending one of those check stations, don't hesitate to get in touch with myself or with Riley Peck, our wildlife manager, and we'd love to have you along on that.
Jason,
yeah.
Is that for the early or the late rifle season?
General rifle.
Just the general one that's in October?
October, yeah, third weekend of October. I think, as you'll recall, I mentioned last time that we've had a high volume of nuisance bear calls starting in about April and not ending even until this point. We're still getting quite a few calls, probably averaging a call a day on a nuisance bear somewhere, if not more than that. So far this summer, we've moved 7 bears, but responded to quite a few other reports of bears and have had other traps up trying to move the bears around. Just a challenging summer for our biologists and bears this year. So kind of going along with our sheep presentation tonight, in the first week of December, we'll be going out to Oregon to get 25 or up to 25 bighorn sheep, Rocky bighorn sheep, to help augment the Stansberry Mountains population. As you recall, we've had a lot of discussion about that population. It's been hit hard by mountain lions in some of those areas, and now we'll be augmenting that again with some more sheep, so we're excited about that. From our aquatic section last month, we spent a day up on the Manti Mountains there above Manti and the Manti Ponds. And we stock brook trout up in that area. And that doesn't get done without the help of volunteers throughout the area down there. We really appreciate those volunteers participating along with our aquatics and hatchery personnel. So it's a great opportunity to get brook trout in some of the smaller beaver ponds and smaller ponds like that up there. Again, for aquatics, the regional personnel have surveyed many of the streams impacted by last year's fires. I think you recall I've talked about that. We've had mudslides and flash floods this year in the Spanish Fork drainage. We had fish kills last year. Some of those fish started to come back, but with the mudslides, the mud flows this year, we've lost fish in those streams again. Those include Thistle Creek, Benny Creek, Nebo Creek, Spanish Fork River, Petite Neat, and Lower Diamond Fork, as well as others, smaller tributaries coming into those. So it's quite an impactful and devastating hit on some of those streams up there. Our sections will continue to be working on rehabilitating the uplands to try to reduce the flows down into the rivers, and then working on rebuilding those river systems. Another couple opportunities to go out with our aquatic staff for our RAC members. On September 19th and 20th, they'll be doing their annual gill nets on Jordanelle River. They'll use curtain nets up there on both days. They'll set one day and gather the next. So if anybody's interested in that, 19th and 20th of September. And then October 22nd through the 24th, they will be electroshocking on the Provo River. So there's a 3-day period if you'd like to get electroshocking on the river. One other note for aquatics, kokanee are starting to run up the Provo River from Jordanelle, so we're excited about that. They've hit the first 2 to 3 miles there, and the kokanee run is well underway on the strawberry as well. Kind of tying into that with our conservation outreach section, we have got a few events happening over the next couple of weeks, and one of those is on Saturday, September 21st, is a kokanee salmon viewing day that's held annually up at the Strawberry Visitor Center. Great event, your opportunity to get up and close to the kokanee salmon and hold them, and just amazing fish. So if you have an opportunity to get to that, I'd try to take that. I mentioned before we have a field dressing clinic scheduled on September 19th also here in Springville. This Thursday, the Utah State Fair begins, and Wildlife Resources has a display up there. This year, the display will be featuring bears and being bear aware. So if you head up to the fair, be sure to stop into our display, our building there, and check that out. Our habitat staff are kind of in the middle of things right now, wrapping up their summer work and getting ready for a busy fall. A lot of requests for proposals out right now for projects, heavy equipment work on projects throughout the region. We've got several fires that they'll be working on. I think many of you saw the fire on West Mountain over here. We'll be cooperating, I think, with the BLM on that fire, as well as a couple of others. So they're just starting to get ramped up for the fall rehabilitation work. And finally, our law enforcement archery hunt is well underway. We've had our officers continue to be in the field checking deer, checking hunters. One of the things about our law enforcement that many of us sometimes may forget is while their primary responsibility is wildlife law enforcement, whenever there's emergencies, they're always on hand to be able to help with that. And I don't know, some of you may have saw in the news there was a drowning up at Strawberry several weeks ago. A young man drowned up there. Our conservation officers happened to be in the area and were on the scene, one of the initial responders to the scene, were able to recover that drowning victim's body. And you think that they're just after law enforcement for wildlife, but they are trained and skilled and have experience in a lot of other areas, so we appreciate their response in those situations as well. Mr. Chair, unless there's any questions from the RAC, I'd be glad to turn it back over to you. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Jason.
So for the next series of this, we're going to hear a presentation. So this is a public forum allowing the public to express their opinions on the proposals and on the management of wildlife in our state. As such, the RAC encourages each of you to do so, to share your opinion. Because without your input, this RAC and Wildlife Board process would fail to function as it's supposed to. The Wildlife Board, not the RAC, is charged with setting wildlife policy for the state. We make recommendations to the board. We all have our ideas about what's best for Utah's wildlife, and today fish. I guess fish count as wildlife. And most of us have real emotions related to our feelings about how we should manage fish and other wildlife. Again, I'd encourage all of you to express your opinion. However, we ask that we respect everybody's opinion, even those with opposing views. I'd appreciate if we'd keep our emotions in check, allow everybody to freely express their opinions. Appropriate conduct will provide a smooth flow of this meeting and allow the RAC to listen and to digest and to consider all the concerns and opinions that are offered. Out-of-line comments are not allowed, and so if behavior like that persists, we may ask the offender to leave. I don't like saying that because we've never had that happen, but it's in the thing I'm supposed to read. This is how it's going to proceed from here on. So the DWR will provide a presentation, then we'll open it to questions from the RAC. After questions from the RAC, the public will be invited to ask questions. This is a time for questions, not to make comment or to express your feelings, but to it's a fact-finding part of the process. After the public questions, there will be public comments. If you would like to make a comment, you need to fill out one of these cards so we have a record of it and pass it in to Ben or somebody over there, and they'll get it up to us. We'll invite you up. At that time, I'd like you to stand up, state your name, state who you represent, yourself or a group, and then you'll have up to 3 minutes to provide your comment. At 3 minutes, I'm going to cut you off so that we have fairness for everybody in the room. After the public comment period, there'll be a time for the DWR representative to stand back up and provide clarification on anything they'd like to clarify based on the questions and comments to that point. After the clarification period, there'll be time for RAT comments, and then we will consider motions to approve or pass anything that's an action item. There are also informational items. I think that's it. So at this point, we'll turn the time over to Craig Walker for a fishing informational time.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and RAC members. My name is Craig Walker. I am the Assistant Chief of Aquatics for the Division of Wildlife Resources. My first presentation tonight in the informational segment is to talk to you a little bit about how we plan in the aquatic section to tailor angler opportunities to meet angler needs for the 2021 regulation cycle and beyond. So first and foremost, why is it important that we tailor angler opportunities to meet angler needs? Firstly, we need to do a better job at addressing public needs, and that became apparent back in 2018 when during the rack and board process, we proposed the removal of some special fly and lure only regulations in southern Utah. The Wildlife Board at that time did not approve of the proposed removal due to apparent mismatch between our suggested regulation change and angler desires. Additionally, during 2018, anglers expressed some concerns over, one, the removal of selected brook trout populations and fishing opportunities in Utah, and two, the need for more bait fishing opportunities on rivers throughout Utah. Listening to all that feedback, the aquatic section personnel agreed with the board and internally to examine the angling experiences, for example, gear restrictions, limits, species, locations we offer statewide, and compare them with the angler preferences that are out there. Tailoring angler opportunities to meet angler needs will also help the Division of Wildlife address one of the potential issues we have facing us, which is crowding. The forecasted Utah population growth is 3.2 million residents currently and anticipated to grow to 5.5 million residents by 2050. Given the fact that we have stable angling participation rates forecasted, that equates to a 7% increase in anglers by 2025, a 26% increase in the number of anglers by 2040, and a forecasted 39% increase in anglers by 2050. The perception of crowding is one of the main reasons why anglers cease fishing participation, which has been documented nationally and in our own surveys. We have a train wreck coming if we don't figure out a way to manage opportunities on the landscape so that everybody can have a little bit of an opportunity. Further, making sure that we are providing satisfying angling experiences is critical to ensuring the relevancy of angling among outdoor recreational pursuits. To ensure angler satisfaction among our anglers, we need to make sure that desired experiences are available proportional to their need. For example, if 20% of anglers prefer to fish for largemouth bass at lakes and reservoirs, then we should strive to manage for largemouth bass opportunities at 20% of our lakes and reservoirs. It only makes sense. Additionally, maintaining angler satisfaction will also require that we ensure that the unique ways anglers participate in the sport of fishing don't conflict with one another. Again, as we encounter population growth, we need to begin thinking about adopting models similar to what USDA Forest Service has in place, where we're splicing up the landscape for off-highway vehicle opportunities, foot and horse traffic opportunities, able to access the same forest, but at different access points or differently. So we now know the why behind providing anglers with the opportunities that they desire. How do we propose getting there? There are four avenues right now that the aquatic section would like to pursue when trying to meet the needs of anglers. First, we would like to begin to assess angler preferences and behaviors. In 2017, in every 5 years, we survey 10,000 anglers via email proportional to their representation among all licensed anglers in the state by license type and by gender, for example. We'd like to analyze the responses from the 2017 statewide attitudinal survey to identify angler behaviors and preferred experiences. We'd like to use behavior and preference results to define preference groups among Utah anglers who seek common experiences. For example, anglers who fish for smaller species in similar species in similar settings, and use similar gear types. And we'd like to identify where those angler preference groups are willing to fish. For example, what is their willingness to travel within 2 hours of where they reside? We would also like to take stock in what our fisheries have to offer through inventories and a capacity assessment. What we're terming inventories is simply an identification of the experiences we currently offer at our waters in Utah. And what we're terming an assessment of capacity is an identification of the variety of experiences that each of these waters is capable of providing. For example, a capacity would be, does a water currently managed for trout have the capacity to be managed for bass, for wiper, for kokanee? Could current regulations be modified at a water to allow for greater harvest? Could regulations be modified at a water to create a gear-specific, for example, fly-only fishing experience? Could infrastructure improvements be made to increase accessibility for shoreline anglers? Can habitat be manipulated to create a new experience at a water? Can smaller fish be stocked at higher densities to increase angler catch rates at a water currently managed for trophy fish at lower catch rates? Thirdly, we'd like to plan on looking at the gaps between what we have to offer in the way of fishing experiences and what anglers want. Gaps are simply the mismatches between the preferences and the offerings, what anglers prefer and what's currently out there. What we'd like to do is find out where are the gaps between preferred fishing experiences and experiences we currently offer. Where are there opportunities to use the capacity that I previously mentioned as a vehicle to address these gaps? And then lastly, what are the gaps that we actually cannot currently address? Finally, we'd like to look at the willingness to travel question. We'd like to take all the data that I've mentioned previously and look at it through the lens of willingness to travel. And willingness to travel is simply the distance an angler is willing to travel to experience their preferred outcome. We'd like to look at where anglers with preferred fishing experiences reside, and then figure out, are there opportunities that we have that anglers are seeking that are available within that radius of travel that they're willing to undertake? So this has been about a 6-month process thus far. We have been analyzing the information, as I mentioned, that we collected from the 2017 survey. You're probably asking, well, what have you done to date? Well, I'm going to go through that right now. We've gone through that data from the 17 survey to assess angler preferences and behaviors, and we found out some information on preferred species, preferred water types, gear preferences, preferred access methods, and the time spent pursuing species, both by residents and non-residents. So with regard to species preference, we've evaluated the strength of the relationship between species preferences to define preference groups, is what we're terming them. And in the case of those that prefer to fish for lake salmonids, they represent 10% of the overall Utah angling public. Warm water fishes or panfish, 4% of the Utah angling public likes to undertake warm water fishing opportunities. 8% of the Utah public goes after bass and walleye. That's their preferred target. 68% of the Utah public prefers to fish for stream salmonids. And then we have a category that's generalists, which means they really didn't have or fit into one of those other four boxes. So additionally, we looked at species preference among our non-resident anglers and found that non-resident anglers who prefer to fish for warm water species do seem to have a greater preference for crappie. And that'll come up later as to why I mentioned that. We have defined method and setting preferences among our anglers by evaluating the strength of the relationships again between fishing method and preferred setting to define other groups. So 8% of anglers in this group that likes to fish by at lakes by boat, 18% of Utah anglers like to fish at lakes via shoreline, and 74% of anglers like to actually wade fish regardless of the setting. We've identified the gear preferences among our anglers. 22% of Utah anglers like to fish with lures. 28% of Utah anglers like to fish with flies. 46% of anglers like to fish with bait in Utah. And 4% like to fish with some other method of terminal tackle. Most importantly, we've taken the next step to assess what fishing experiences our anglers want by looking at the relationships of the preferences that I've mentioned thus far. Specifically, we've examined the relationship between species preference and gear preference. And hopefully I don't end up forwarding the slide here if I can use my cursor, which isn't going to show up on there. Maybe it'll show up over here. That's all right. Do you have a pointer? Okay. Well, for those of you that are watching the presentation, there's quadrants in this diagram. Within those quadrants, we have gear preferences as well as species preferences. What we've done is we've shown the overlap between those gear preferences and the species preferences. It happens that bass and walleye anglers, as well as salmonid anglers on lakes, prefer to fish with lures. Those that seek stream salmonid fishing opportunities, of course, seem to prefer flies. Seems kind of a no-brainer. Warm water anglers and generalists seem to prefer bait. Another thing that we're noticing as we start to plot this information, and I'd like to call your attention to this, along the x-axis on the bottom, we go from lake-oriented anglers to your left to stream-oriented anglers on your right. And then we're noticing what we're terming gear investment on the y-axis. As we move from warm water generalist anglers who prefer to fish for bait, the investment being low there, we go to a moderate investment of fly anglers that fish on streams, to a higher investment of gear in lures for bass and walleye anglers and lake salmonid anglers. We've also looked at the relationship between angler gear preferences and their preferences for access methods at particular settings. Those that fish with lures like to fish by boat at lakes. Those that fish with bait like to fish at lakes on the shoreline. Those that like to wade fish primarily like to fish with flies. Again, on the x-axis, we have moving from left to right, lake to river orientation. However, in this diagram here, we've noticed that on the y-axis, it's what we're terming a mobility component, where sedentary anglers that like to fish with bait on a shoreline are less mobile than those using their own energy to wade fish using flies than those using motorized boating to fish for other species using lures. With regard to behaviors, we've begun to examine resident and non-resident anglers' investments of time when pursuing species in Utah and elsewhere. First, I want to point out that among resident anglers depicted in this diagram, the majority of time invested in fishing, regardless of species, is spent here in Utah. That's a good thing. That's an indication that we are providing quality fishing opportunities in this state and that anglers are not having to seek satisfactory opportunities outside of the state of Utah. The second thing that I'd like to point out is the large investment of time that non-resident anglers apparently spend pursuing warm water fishing opportunities in Utah. Remember the figure I showed you earlier where many of the non-residents who prefer to fish for warm water fishes prefer to fish for crappie. These results combined with what is shown here are an indication that non-residents are coming to Utah to fish for warm water species and that crappie fishing is likely driving that behavior. The third finding I'd like to point out in this diagram is the fact that non-resident anglers are investing a greater amount of time pursuing bass and walleye opportunities in other states. This indicates to us that there might be better angling opportunities for these species outside of Utah. So, I'd now like to walk you through a few scenarios and examples of changes that we might undertake based on our preliminary results to date. First, we might change regulations. In the instance of crappie regulations, non-resident anglers seek warm water fishing experiences in Utah more than in other states. I pointed that out. Non-resident warm water anglers in Utah are also more likely to prefer crappie fishing. We're hedging that if we liberalize crappie regulations at some Utah waters, we're likely to encourage greater non-resident angler use of Utah's fisheries. Second, we might change how we manage certain species in Utah. Right now, non-resident anglers seek bass and walleye fishing opportunities in other states more than in Utah. What we need to do is examine what largemouth bass and walleye management efforts are undertaken in other states, compare them to what we offer, and then ask ourselves, can Utah's efforts be improved? If so, would that improvement in our management of largemouth bass and or walleye attract more non-resident anglers? Third, we might change how we manage access and amenities at certain settings. So as I mentioned earlier, anglers who prefer fishing for warm water species are more likely to fish from shore using bait. Some of the other preliminary information that we've collected indicates that these anglers are also more likely to keep fish for food and prefer to fish at locations where amenities, for example, restrooms and fish cleaning stations, are found. Right now, as many of you know, if you fished the shorelines of Utah's lakes and reservoirs, there is a lack of developed shoreline access at Utah's warm water fisheries. Additionally, outside of community fisheries in the state, we don't have any cleaning stations tailored to the needs of shoreline anglers anywhere in Utah. Our thought is that by improving shoreline opportunities, we'll address the needs of what we view as an underserved portion of Utah's angling public. So these are just some examples of some of the things that we can do from a management standpoint at our fisheries with the data that we've analyzed thus far, only 6 months in. So where do we go from here? We continue to evaluate the preferences and begin grouping anglers even more so from existing survey data, similar to the groupings that I showed you earlier tonight. We examine the willingness to travel among identified angler preference groups residing in certain localities or zip codes. We inventory and assess capacity of existing fisheries to meet the needs of angler preference groups. We modify management of fisheries where needed and feasible to meet the needs of anglers. We address the gaps that I mentioned earlier with the creation of new angling opportunities. We examine another survey that we have in our coffers, which is the lapsed angler survey. We look at those data and assess the constraints to angling participation in the state of Utah. We incrementally propose data-driven regulatory changes between 2021 and 2029 to the RACs and the Wildlife Board to address the gaps at a 2-year interval. We continue to survey anglers at 5-year intervals in a manner that allows us to adapt to changing angler preferences and behaviors, changing habitat conditions, and increased demand for our fishing resources. And finally, we continue to keep our finger on the pulse of the anglers to assess their response to the management changes that we prescribe to you all that hopefully will meet with your approval. With that, I'd like to thank you, and I'll take any comments at this time or questions.
Craig, question for you. So you had a survey in 2017. You're not going to have another one until 2022?
2021, 2022 will be the cycle. So we start it just pre-winter and then run it through 2 calendar years.
Other questions for Craig?
On the slide that showed the percentage of what anglers enjoy using, what kind of water they enjoy using, it said 68% of the anglers surveyed were stream anglers.
Yep.
And only 10% were lake anglers. So from that survey, you surmise that almost 70% of Utah's anglers are stream fishermen.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, and I didn't get into it, but if you actually go to this slide here and you look at stream salmonid preferences among non-resident anglers, they're still fishing in another state when they're seeking stream salmonid opportunities. The reason why we have 68% of our anglers going after stream salmonids is because really 68% of our waters are stream salmonid waters in the state, if you look at it broadly. We didn't have a lot in the way of natural lakes. We have reservoirs that we've created, but predominantly we're stream trout. We have an opportunity to encourage greater non-resident participation in tourism by harnessing that stream salmonid component in the state.
And then, so on the one slide, you showed that the growth of the population growth of Utah is expanding, and that's going to expand the angler and angler pressure. But throughout your presentation, it seemed like you were just focused on expanding non-resident, drawing non-resident in through tourism. Is that kind of the direction you're trying to head to?
Not at all. Those are just examples of some of the power of the data that we had at hand that really described with the preliminary information what we can do. This is designed to be balanced based upon, you know, what we have from a Utah angling standpoint, resident and non-resident. I think the thing we're going to struggle with is with the stable participation rate, with the forecasted change in the number of anglers out in the landscape, when we have a 39% increase forecasted by 2050, granted I'll be retired, but we need to start managing opportunities differently. We need to not be reactive and be proactive. We need to carve up the landscape in a way that everybody has an opportunity to seek out what they like to do among all of the different things that people do within the umbrella of fishing. That's kind of the idea here. Go ahead.
I have one question as well. It seemed like a lot of the presentation was about what the preferences are, what their current status is, and how we close those gaps. And the example you gave is, for example, if 20% of people want to chase largemouth bass, then 20% of our lakes should be managed for largemouth bass. But there was nothing about the ecology of the system. You're proposing that we're going to use exotic species in 20% of our waters as the plan. Shouldn't we be focused on the ecology of the system as much or more as providing opportunity to meet the needs of the public?
From our standpoint in the aquatic section right now, managing sport fish safely to conserve and preserve the ecological aspect of our systems is critical. I think that, you know, if you look at some of the efforts that we've made toward using sterile species in a lot of our reservoirs, sterile walleye is the most recent effort, but wipers, tiger muskellunge, we're using biological controls to reduce the need to use chemicals in systems and treat. Again, managing ecologically sound principles alongside of sport fish principles.
Okay.
We're using sterile species in an effort to mitigate escapement risk to our native species downstream in our recovery waters. We are, for the first time, I think, as a section, from a native recovery sport fish standpoint, at a greater point of balance than we've ever been.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep.
Craig.
Yeah,
okay. The highest percentage of fishermen seem to be the shore anglers or amongst the salmonoid. My question was, I was one of those shore fishermen until I finally got to a situation where I could afford a boat. Have you taken into any consideration those that own boats compared to those that don't? I mean, for instance, if you don't own a boat and you want to fish, you fish from the shore. And a lot of people can't afford boats, especially the price they are nowadays.
Yeah, and that's when I mentioned that underserved aspect of that. anything we can do to meet the needs of our shoreline anglers, you know, to me, that's the gateway drug of fishing, really, is you're on a reservoir or a lake, and you don't have much in the way of impediments to casting. You're going to go out there, you're going to sit, you're going to wait, you're sedentary, you're fishing with bait. It's an entry-level sport. And if we fail to address the needs of shoreline angling on our lakes and reservoirs, we're cutting the legs out from under our recruitment model for new anglers. Which, you know, it's an odd thing. We talked about the population growth, and we struggle with this all the time, is, you know, we're really trying to recruit new anglers into the fold so that we don't become the stale, pale male sport out there. At the same time, we're trying to retain anglers by providing community opportunities for older anglers that can't necessarily access the fisheries that they used to via boat or wading or whatever it is. We have a conundrum because as we try to do those things, and just by virtue of there being a stable participation rate on a per capita basis, we're exacerbating what we view as potentially a problem, which is too few resources for too many anglers. Not right now. I mean, we're not there at all yet. But 10, 15, 20 years down the road, we're going to be there. That's why it's critical for us to start to, I think it's doable. It's critical for us to start looking at really providing very unique niche activities that people can undertake within the sport of fishing. It's kind of what we're trying to do.
Well, I understand where you're headed. I think I got a lot more to learn about it, but I agree that you need to take care of all the anglers.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ecological things that you brought up, and it was one of the drivers behind this, is anglers came forward to us and said, you know, you've killed all the brook trout populations. Where did all the brook trout populations go? We have a job to do. You know, we took brook trout out of the equation because of cutthroat trout conservation and restoration activities. Are there areas in the state where we can bring brook trout back in safely from an ecological standpoint? Yeah, probably. And we need to examine that. Those are those gaps, those, you know, seeing what the capacity of a water could be safely from a biological standpoint.
As long as they're sterile.
As long as they're sterile, right? Well, I mean, in some areas, if you don't have an issue with stunting and there's not a risk of escapement and impact to other trout species, what's the problem with having a fertile population? The only problem we have is an enforcement problem, which is the illegal bait or legal stocking and transfer issue, but that's a whole other problem.
Can you talk real quickly about the division's efforts to increase or enhance walk-in access programs? I think Mike's question sort of begs the question, which is, what is the DWR doing to enhance, you know, fence crossing structures, public-private access, things like that? If it's 70% of the states or of the states trying to get on a stream, what's the DWR doing to enhance that relationship with private stream owners?
Walk-in access is valuable, but it's not my go-to when trying to address that issue. My go-to and working with my folks is to actually begin to get into partnerships with landowners and do some landscape conservation activities, stream restoration activities in exchange for access to the stream corridor. I think that's the win-win you're shooting for. And it's not that the walk-in access program is a bad thing, but it's pretty much in lieu of payment, no access, right? What we're trying to do is have a more long-standing relationship with landowners, showcase the fact that we're good stewards of the land. They want to be good stewards of the land. And by partnering in that regard, we can actually work together to also maintain angler access. That's kind of what I'm shooting for long term.
Thanks.
Other questions from the rack? Any questions from the public?
My name's Robert Judd. So, Craig, my question is simply, of the amount of energy and money that you have in stocking waters of the state of Utah, 70% of the people want to stream stock or salmonid fish. So what is your percentage of fish that you're putting out in waters? Is it, you know, 30, 70, or what? Do you know what that percentage is?
Well, first off, the beauty of most of our stream populations of salmonids is the fact that they are self-sustaining. We don't have to augment. In fact, we've moved off of augmentation of most of our stream populations in the state compared to what we did 20 years ago. I don't know off the top of my head what that ratio is, but it is probably 90% flatwater stocking of salmonids, 10% stream stocking of salmonids, whereas 20 years ago it was probably about 50-50. We recognize the fact that to provide a quality product in our streams, we didn't necessarily have to augment those populations. And in fact, in most instances, to provide the quality product that we would like to see a little bit more harvest in a lot of situations. We've discussed managing and manipulating water in a way that would actually cause year class failure among some of our stream salmonids, and then actually bolster the overall population health rather than have a bunch of stunted, starving fish in many instances. I won't say starving, but just not in as good a condition as we'd like.
Thanks, Bob, for that. Simply
one question.
My question is simply, what's the percentage of warm water stocking versus your salmonid stockings?
Oh. Statewide, flatwater, rivers, doesn't matter?
Doesn't matter.
Goodness. We are probably 15 to 20% warm water. And that's a kind of pull it out of my rear end response. I'm just guesstimating there. It's around that.
Other questions.
It's one thing to call that a static figure, but that the number of anglers expressing preference for salmonids is incrementally declining through time. Over three surveys, we've seen about an 8% decline in that preference category. That combined with the fact that in our lakes and reservoirs, we're running into situations where traditionally, we were able to manage with salmonids because of the water temperatures and dissolved oxygen situations that we had. We don't necessarily have those anymore, even in some of our higher lakes, the Diamond Lakes this year, for example. And in an effort to avoid fish kills and maximize the benefit of the fish that we stock, we are examining moving into the warm and cool water species realm in those situations.
Excellent. So that everybody here knows, all of these presentations are typically now posted a week in advance on the division's website. This time, they did not meet that week in advance. In fact, I think they were just posted today. And along with those postings, so anybody can go a week before this meeting, they can look at the presentations, they can hear everything that's going to be presented, and there is an online place where you can provide comment or question there, especially when it doesn't relate to the current topics of that night. There are two people today that have comments. It probably is most fitting here. Normally, we don't take questions or comments for an informational presentation, but because those weren't up a week in advance, Jason and I thought this is probably the most appropriate time to have the two comments that aren't directly relating to one of our action items tonight. And so, unless there's a disagreement among the RAC, we will invite those two individuals to provide their comment now. So the first one is Jim Green.
Thank you. Jim Green and John Van Sloten is with me. We live on the Provo River between Deer Creek Reservoir and Legacy Bridge. And I've lived there for 11 years, and I've watched the fish population decline significantly up there, partially because of the increased population growth. Our Wasatch County is one of the fastest growing counties in the nation right now, and the introduction of river otters up there, which have helped decimate our fish population. And so that section of the river has no restrictions on it like the rest of the Provo does, and we're just concerned that that if we don't restrict it, we're going to see the fish population continue to decline. And so we're just hoping that maybe something might be done where we could restrict that possibly to like above the Legacy Bridge with two fish under 15 inches and artificial lures only, that might help to preserve the fish population there. We just wondered what might be considered to be done in the future for that.
Excellent. So that's comments for Craig and the fisheries biologist here in the region.
I don't want to speak completely for Chris, but I mean, what we do is we go out and we assess populations to the best of our ability using electrofishing or other gears. We look at what those populations are doing health-wise. We look at their age structure, size structure, condition factor, growth rates, where possible. And then we assess whether or not those populations are achieving the management objective for that particular water or segment of water. And I think that is what you are planning on doing shortly.
Yeah, I can just speak to that.
Sure.
I think we're well poised to examine that issue this year, actually. We're having our surveys that are taking place in October, and I've already given some dates to the other gentlemen. I'd be happy to give those to you. I encourage you guys to come out and help us with that survey and see for yourself what we have. And then once we have that data, we can compare it to what we've seen in previous years. We typically survey the Middle Provo about once every 3 to 5 years. So I'm not disputing what you're seeing, but let's actually take a look at the data and see before we make any judgment calls there. Also, we also have a creel survey going on right now on the Middle Provo, which is where we talk to anglers. So again, I think we'll be well poised to address that problem. And if we, the RAC would like, after we've had a chance to kind of crunch that data, we'd be happy to bring it back and let you know what we've seen.
That'd be great. Our second comment is John Van Sloten, if I said that right.
It's Van Sloten, but I've heard of that pronounced like that way many, many times. So I echo Jim's comments. The only thing I would have throw a couple issues on the table to consider. One is address the stocking issue again. It's clear if you change the stocking levels, you've had a desired result. There's less fish there. So that's another issue to address. The other issue is that particular section is very convenient to fish. There's a lot of people that come there because it's 45 minutes from Salt Lake City, and there is a lot of stream fishing within that proximity. So where you got two hours to get there, that section gets fished quite a bit, and it needs to be addressed because I think you can see a lot more fishermen in there. So that's all I've got.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I don't know if you want to add anything, Greg, but...
Yeah, just to speak to that, you know, fish populations either grow, wax, or wane as a result of recruitment or stocking, right? Those are the two things. So they either naturally reproduce and replace themselves, or we replace them. I don't know if anybody has fished in Idaho recently for any species. They have undertaken over the past decade what is a pretty amazing program. They have gone out and they've tagged fish in the majority of their waters. And they've tagged those fish with reward tags in an effort to have tag returns allow them to assess what the exploitation rate is, or what the removal rate is for those fish. If you can look at the removal rate, and you can look at the natural recruitment, and natural recruitment isn't replacing the removal rate, that's your free board for stocking, right? We right now, in the spring of 2020, we kind of get our hand forced a little bit by the director, but he thought it was such a good idea, he's going to have us do it in the spring. We're going to pilot a similar tagging program on our community waters, just to make sure we have all of our ducks in a row as far as how the program works, and then expand it out to more waters in Utah. And with that, be able to assess exploitation, the removal, look at the natural recruitment in the waters, and then fill those gaps with stocking where possible.
Thank you. Our next item is item number 6, private fish ponds rule amendments.
Mr. Chair, I have actually two informational items, and Stacy didn't space them out. I apologize for that.
Absolutely. Let's have the other one, Craig.
So she tasked me with having some transition. So here's my transition. So my second presentation tonight is a discussion of how we plan to simplify certificates of registration for fishing tournaments in the state of Utah. Before I get there, some background on CORs. A certificate of registration, or COR, is a special permit that covers certain wildlife-related activities. People who want to participate in activities that require a COR currently apply for their permit using a paper application downloaded from the DWR website as a PDF. They then fill out that application and send it in to us as a hard copy. These applications are reviewed by regional and Salt Lake DWR personnel and are then approved or denied on a case-by-case basis. The COR application process has come under some recent scrutiny for a variety of reasons. The public is dissatisfied with what they view as a flawed certificate of registration application process. Our review of COR applications is time-consuming, and as a result, it is not uncommon for us to have a backlog of COR applications awaiting approval. For these reasons, the Division of Wildlife wants to create a more efficient COR application process for a variety of COR types. One of the first types that we're going to look at building in some efficiencies in the application process is the fishing tournament COR. Right now, the automated application process that we foresee would provide guidance to applicants regarding the eligibility of their request. It would address rule requirements as they relate to AIS certification, the number of participants in a tournament, prize values, whether or not the tournament is a live weigh-in, the species for the tournament, and the adherence to fishing regulations for tournament participants. I'd like to note that the primary function of fishing tournament CORs is to prevent scheduling of multiple tournaments at a water on the same day and to minimize conflicts with non-tournament anglers. Right now, our online application would address conflict by not allowing tournaments to occur on any of the following days: holidays, pre-fishing days, a location or date determined by DWR or other managers to be ineligible, or a date at a location already secured by another fishing tournament. In addition to addressing these conflicts, our new application process would provide guidance to applicants regarding the eligibility of their request and rule requirements, for example, their AIS certification requirements if they were using boats in a tournament. So our DTS folks put together a mock-up of what we hope to unleash here in another year or so. What I'd like to do tonight is walk you through a few scenarios under that mock-up so that you can see kind of how this is going to work in making this a more efficient process. The first thing I'd like to show you is what we term a date collision. So I mentioned the fact that we're not supposed to have tournaments at the same water on the same day. That's written in rule right now. Well, rather than go in and have people review that by hand, what we'd have is a situation where individuals would fill out their application and they would be notified based upon a database that the event that they had did indeed need DWR authorization, but the dates that they've chosen have already been reserved for a tournament. They'd need to adjust their tournament dates and select another water body. Once they've done that and gotten to a point where they have a date that is available, they would then add some additional information regarding the tournament director and the organization. If they were using boats in their tournament, they would sign off and certify that they agree to the rules and stipulations associated with our boat certification program. They would then be forwarded to a payment screen. And once they finish their payment, they would be provided with an electronic copy of their COR for either printout or emailing to themselves and their organization. Second similar scenario is simply one that individuals go through. They enter their information. They are informed that they do indeed need DWR authorization, and they are prompted to continue through the process of entering additional information regarding the tournament organizer and their tournament group, entering any information and certifying that they are adhering to the rules and stipulations related to AIS protections. they'd get to their payment screen, make their payment, and then be provided with an opportunity to print out or download their COR as a PDF. The third scenario would be one in which there was no COR required. Currently, applications are submitted, they have to go through a review process, enter into the backlog that I mentioned potentially earlier, and then come to find out, after review, they don't actually need a COR for their tournament, because it's a friendly tournament. It didn't have the number of individuals required to have a tournament COR. It didn't have the prize value. Well, in this case, they would enter all that information up front, and they would be informed that they don't need to have a COR. And our DTS folks said, just go have fun. We'll have a better message than that. But, that's kind of what we want to do, is make this as easy and as fun as possible for our anglers. And the final scenario that we would encompass in this automated COR application process for tournaments would be tagged fish tournaments. Tagged fish tournaments would still be under the supervision of the Division of Wildlife Resources and done in coordination with the Division of Wildlife Resources. The tags would be implanted in the fish either by Division of Wildlife Resources personnel or someone working in their stead who has had the proper training. Those seeking to have tagged fishing contests would be provided a message where they have indicated they've desired to use tagged fish for this tournament. They will need to confer with their regional DWR representative prior to identifying the date for the tournament and paying their fee. They would be provided with the contact information for their local regional DWR official. So those are the four different scenarios for the tagged fish contest. What do we plan to do with that mock-up? Well, we plan to activate that mock-up and have it be a functional application portal for fishing tournament CORs in 2021. And that 2021 rollout will also include the creation of a monthly report that identifies tournament dates and locations for web publication and availability to the public. In addition to the automated portal, we do plan on having a 2021 proposal for modification of the fishing tournament rule, and that will be presented to you all in fall of 2020. The rationale behind that rule change is historically the fishing tournament COR was designed to prevent overharvest and mortality of stocked fish. We don't see the evidence of that anymore in this state. And for that reason, we need to actually make a rule that is meeting with the needs of the modern angler and the modern manager. So that's our plan. With that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity. Take any questions or comments?
Questions from the rack.
Yeah, Craig, one question. You talked about I think it's great that you're simplifying the rules. It helps with the public, but I do have one question. You said live weigh-in. Would that be that if you went out fishing and you caught fish and threw them in your live well, and then you came in and weighed them, those fish cannot be returned to the water legally? Because you can't take a fish out of your live well and return it to the lake.
Right now, for smallmouth bass and largemouth bass anglers in the state, they can indeed.
They can do that?
You described, yeah.
Okay.
Craig, are the criteria for these different types of events outlined somewhere? I'm just wondering if somebody's trying to put together this type versus that type. Do they have some sort of an outline to say, hey, if I'm less than 50 anglers, I don't need X, Y, or Z? Is that information available, or should it be available as part of this?
It is absolutely available in rule, and I wish I could rattle off the rule number right now.
Will it be with this website or a link on there so folks who are trying to work their way through that
can reference
that?
Yeah, so as they go through it, it will spell out, you can't do this under R657, blah. Whatever it is, and it'll spell out what that stipulation is. Right now, we have a situation where, for various reasons, the rule was put together in a very piecemeal fashion, which is one of the needs to rewrite it. We have cold water tournaments that only allow for 200 cold water being trout, 200 participants, and $2,000 in prize money. We have warm and cool water species tournaments that there's no limit. And no one can explain to me the rationale behind 200, 2,000. You just can't. I can see, you know, back in the day when we had an opening day, when we had a situation where we were more concerned about mortalities. Yeah. When there's a concern about gambling with a stocked fish, okay. But to be honest, you know, tournament angling in other parts of the country is a very valuable undertaking. We talked about ecology. You know, tournament bass anglers in southeastern United States are some of the largest conservationists and conservation organizations in the world. And we have an opportunity to potentially harness the power of that and get anglers to be thinking about that. This, in a way, is dangling a carrot by making the process a little bit easier and bringing them to the table. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you, Craig. Okay, I think we'll move on to number six. Now I'll ask Randy Hoeplinger to come up.
That's me again there.
That's you again, huh?
Yeah.
Can I make one comment before Craig starts? I just wanted to follow up on what Brock was indicating about the videos that are going to be coming out online. I meant to mention that, but I didn't turn my paper over to mention that. So, as he mentioned, it's going to be a new process for the division. We'll be posting the presentations, videos of the presentations online about a week before our RAC begins. Along with those presentations, there will be links to an email, and people will be able to go online and provide comments for each of the individual presentations. Those comments will then be put together into an email and be sent to each of the individual RAC members. I don't know if some of you saw today that you got an email probably saying you've just been included into a Google group. If you haven't, it will be coming. And at the end of each day during that week between the posting and our RAC meeting, you will all receive comments grouped together and bundled together for that presentation. And then as we gather here and go through the process again and have look at public comment, that public comment can include not only comments that are here, but comment from the emails that you received as well, and those can be discussed and for their merit and moved upon for votes as the committee decides, the council decides. So we are still trying to figure out how to do this efficiently and effectively, so that's why it didn't happen this go around. But we anticipate for our November RAC meeting for the big game and turkeys and all of that, that will be functional and just be ready to start receiving some emails and compiling comments. So any questions on that, Mike?
Will we know where the commenter lives? What portion of the state they live in?
That is a great question. Did we discuss that? I don't think we discussed that, did we?
Because it's like so...
Yeah, that's a great question. Maybe we'll need to look at that again, and that's something we didn't consider, I don't think.
In some of the past RACs, we've received, most of the emails I've received have been from non-residents of Utah, and their opinion maybe doesn't carry as much weight for me because they're not a resident of the state, and the state owns the wildlife, and the citizenry of the state should decide. And so I'm a little concerned that you're going to send us a bunch of emails from people that I don't know who they are, which could actually undermine the system of people showing up at the RACs to express themselves.
Sure, and I think as we discussed this and trying to come up with a way that seemed fair and equitable, but still visible for everybody to see what's going on, we're struggling through that. I know other states have the same process. We're going to reach out to them and see how they work through that and what makes sense to them. But I think your point's well taken, and that's not obviously the intent of opening it up to comments online. We want to make sure that we get comments from the right people on the right topics to be able to help you be informed and make decisions. So I'll take that back and we'll look into that. Ben?
Are these comments anonymous, or do they include their name? And, well, I guess we don't know if they are including their residency, but...
So I think we decided to have them include their names, if I remember right.
I would hope so, because if somebody comes here to comment, they have to fill out a RAC card.
Yeah.
They have to put their name down. They put their address, phone number.
Do they represent?
And we did talk.
I would hope that we're not just taking anonymous.
That's not the
comments.
Intent. Yeah, and you know, I know the BLM and the Forest Service, they receive comments on EAs and EISs, and they'll oftentimes get copy and paste from a lot of different groups, and you get the same comments 10,000 times, and we're trying to figure out how to work through that as well. So
yeah, I imagine we will see that. We've seen it before, just in emails.
Sure. And I think you know how you in your minds what those mean to each of you individually. So
when you can even have the same person using different email addresses and different, you know, trying to weigh that public input. It'll be interesting to see how it works out, but there are some problems with the anonymity of online commenting.
One of the things that I think we're able to look at is the addresses of the computers, so that you can see if the same computer sending in a whole bunch of comments as well. So
see if we're getting thousands from Nigeria.
Yeah.
Or wherever. Because that may happen as well.
Yeah.
I mean... I think it's a cool concept. If I'm being honest, I'm still going to weigh the opinions that are shared here at the mic way heavier than anything that comes online.
Sure.
The people that show up are the people that care. It's really easy to fill in a comment box on a website and hit submit.
Yeah, and I think it's something we're going to have to test and go through as well. We don't want to waste the council's time as well with comments that are unnecessary or don't make sense. So,
well, and there's another good point is, I mean, somebody makes a comment online, they watch the presentation, they give their comment, they're likely not going to receive any feedback from that versus somebody that's here. I mean, we've seen it tonight. The two gentlemen here commented and got a response. You know, so.
I just remember here just a little over a year ago when we had an issue come before the RACs and Wildlife Board, and I got emails from all over the world. I mean, from basically all over the world opposing what the RACs were doing, so. And I don't. That doesn't carry any weight at all with me, especially when they were all basically saying the same thing. I agree with Ben that more weight's carried right here at the pulpit than.
I generally agree, but I like the idea of seeing how it's going to work, because there are some people that can't make it to this meeting for whatever reason, and maybe it's valuable for a few people to be able to comment on something they're passionate about that they can't get to this meeting. Thank you. Okay, Craig, back to you.
I think you have one more comment.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Is it possible that they could enter their division CID number? I mean, not everybody would have to. If people did, then that would give credence to them standing at the...
Yeah, that's a great idea. I don't know if we've discussed that, but I can take that back as well.
Any other comments? Craig. Probably the fish pond rule amendments. I'm letting you go now. I'm stopping them all if they try to cut in.
So I am presenting in Randy's stead. He is kind of the progenitor of a lot of the negotiations with the PAC and the aquaponics rule, but I will do my darndest to get it going here. So as I mentioned, I'd like to talk to you tonight about how we plan to develop or propose to develop the aquaponics rule. First, before I get there, I'd like to talk a little bit about the PAC. The Private Aquaculture Advisory Council was established by the Utah Legislature in 2017. It is made up of private aquaculturists, private pond owners, anglers, the Division of Wildlife Resources, and UDAF. One goal of the PAC is to give advice and recommendations to the Wildlife Board on rules accepted concerning the regulation of private fish ponds, private stocking, and short-term fishing events. And the PAC also advises on the aquatic animal species authorized for importation or use in aquaculture facilities, fee fishing facilities, private fish ponds, short-term fishing events, and private stocking. In a meeting earlier this year, the PAC discussed aquaponics specifically, primarily because it is increasing in popularity across the nation, in the world, actually. And we do not currently address it specifically in our Division of Wildlife Resources rules. We have historically handled aquaponics under UDWR Rule 65759 as a private fish pond. It's kind of a misuse of that rule, though, because aquaponics facilities do indeed have lower fish escapement risk than ponds that we traditionally think about, and because in most instances they are indeed closed loop systems. Closed loop meaning the fact that they are indoors, use culinary water as their water source, and usually discharge their water into a sewer or septic system. So the PAC recommended that we establish criteria where aquaponics facilities can operate without a certificate of registration. The Division of Wildlife Resources then developed language that was approved by the PAC regarding that issue. Right now, the Division of Wildlife Resources is recommending adding language to R657-59 that establishes criteria for when an aquaponics facility can operate without a COR. The division currently recommends that no COR is necessary, provided the following: that the aquaponics facility is a hobby, quote unquote, operation, which means that it is for personal or educational use. The facility is a closed loop facility, as I mentioned before. All applicable health rules are followed when importing fish. Fish cannot leave the facility alive. And the species of fish raised is from a Division of Wildlife Resources developed list. What list, you say? Well, here is the list that the Division of Wildlife Resources developed. That list is inclusive of koi, bluegill, hybrid bluegill, which are the bluegill-green sunfish hybrid, red ear sunfish, green sunfish, striped bass, white bass, hybrid striped bass or wiper, largemouth, smallmouth, channel catfish, fathead minnows, black crappie, white crappie, rainbow trout, cutthroat trout, brown trout, brook trout, tiger trout, walleye, and golden shiner. Those fish are all present on the landscape in Utah and are all available from Fish Health Certified sources. In addition to those fish, we recommend that all other non-controlled species for possession and importation under 657-3 be included in this list. So after reviewing the list, the aquaponics industry proposed adding a few species, jade perch, sleepy cod, and tiger shrimp, to the no COR species list. We conferred internally between sport fish, native fish, our fisheries health personnel, our AIS personnel, aquatic invasive species personnel, within the aquatic section, and we came to the decision that we would not add these species to the list for the following reasons. Currently, there are no escaped wild populations of any of those species that occur in the United States. They are indeed considered invasive where they have escaped in other countries, and they can carry diseases that threaten cultured and wild fish. That does not preclude them from being raised. It just means that you actually have to go and get a COR approved if you want to raise these species as part of your aquaponics effort. CORs will still be available and will be granted in instances where the following. The aquaponics facility is not a hobby operation, as I described before, and it's actually commercial. In that case, a COR can be obtained from the UDOT Department of Agriculture and Food. The facility is not closed loop. Some fish health rules cannot be met. Fish will leave the facility alive. Or the species of fish raised is not from the no COR list. So basically the inverse of what I described earlier. Some species will still be requiring a variance from the Wildlife Board for approval. And that is what we have in the way of a proposed aquaponics rule. I'd like to thank you all, and I'd like to thank the PAC for their input on the recommended rule, as well as the Utah aquaponics industry for their input on the species list. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Excellent. Thank you, Craig. Questions from the RAC?
Ben has one.
Go ahead. Let's go Eric first, then Ben.
How are you going to, police this from those that may not have a COR from just, you know, there's always those that may just take a bunch and turn them loose, you know, in a spot that's not. So how does that be regulated or controlled to where you could track those?
For those that actually don't pursue a COR?
Yeah.
The idea is right now to actually set up something that is more easily attainable for aquaponics folks, that clearly spells out what they can and can't do. That opens their aquaponics operations up to a broader array of species because of the higher level of safety with those aquaponics facilities. Our thought is that that is going to encourage people that may have skirted the COR process in the past, maybe just because they didn't view it as necessary, maybe become willing participants and undertake the voluntary compliance that most of our COR programs rely on. In the event that we do find out about bad actors, that's an enforcement issue. But it's like anything we deal with. I mean, even regulations out in the landscape. It's a voluntary compliance issue until caught. Or turned in. So we hope by making things a little easier for people that we'll get more compliance. That's the thought process.
Ben.
Yeah, I may have been misled by some of the pictures in the slideshow, but are we basically just talking about really big fish tanks?
If you were to talk to the folks that do aquaponics, no. They're fish tanks that are designed to use the nutrients and the waste to actually grow other things. It's kind of a new movement, if you will, allowing people to produce their own food, allowing people to utilize fish as a source of fertilizer to produce that food. So, yeah, aquaponics it's more than just a fish tank. It takes a little extra work. And the scales vary. If you're actually selling the material, as I mentioned before, it comes under agricultural and food oversight. But for this, it's more of a personal use standpoint where I think in this picture here, it looks like they're growing basil, maybe. But think gardening, but with a natural fertilizer source.
Okay.
It's like having chickens.
Any other questions from the RAC? Questions from the public. Question.
So my name is Robert Jed. I actually have an updated version of the page that has the species that were approved. And I don't know if that was made of clear to you, Craig, or not, or on the presentation, but I just don't want the RAC to think that it actually eliminates koi and adds yellow perch. It came from Stacy Coons. So, but the reason why is koi is not a game fish, and
so
you have no
jurisdiction
over it. So,
hmm.
I can neither confirm or deny what was just stated.
Awesome.
But if Stacy forwarded that to you?
Yeah, I can forward it.
Yeah, that's fine. That just means that this is an older version of the presentation.
Seems like she sent out an update. Was it yesterday or earlier today? It may have been. That may have been it. I don't.
Craig, if you want.
Any other questions from the public? Okay, I have one comment card. I'm going to invite you back up, Robert, for your comment.
Robert is indeed correct.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm kind of into this because I own a trout farm and I deal a lot with these aquaponics people who are wanting fish to be able to grow in their systems. I've been at every PAC meeting and we've tried to work through this, and it is a good... it is a good step by the division to try to go this direction. Most of these people don't want to have to deal with all the regulatory side of just trying to grow some plants, and they use the fish to grow their plants. And on our side, from a person growing the fish to sell them, retail them, it's just not worth our time for the amount that they buy. You know, they want a lot of fish, 5 fish or something like that. And this really will close a loophole that's in the system, and I really do want to thank the division for working on this, and I think it will be a very good thing for aquaponics and for the state in a whole.
Hey, Robert, will you state who you represent?
Robert Judd. My farm is Spring Lake Trout Farm, and then I also represent the Utah Aquaculture Association.
Thank you very much. Back to the... I guess it's time any clarification, but you already provided that the list does not include.
Yeah, so koi is removed and yellow perch is added from what I can see, which is what you stated, correct?
Excellent.
Yep.
Comments from the rack.
I think it's a great idea to simplify things and do what you've just done.
Make a motion that we approve as presented.
I'll second that.
So a motion has been made that we approve as presented by Mike and seconded by Ken. Any discussion? All in favor? Unanimous.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Craig. Next item is Jace, the Bighorn Sheep Unit Management Plan.
Okay, my name is Jace Taylor. I'm the Bighorn Sheep and Mountain Goat Biologist for the Division of Wildlife. And today what I'll be presenting are the Bighorn Sheep Unit Management Plans. A little bit of background as to why we're presenting these now. In November of 2018, we presented and then approved by the board the statewide Bighorn Sheep Management Plan. And with that new management plan, there were some updates that we needed to make to the unit-specific management plans. The unit-specific management plans go into more detail of area-specific hurdles or concerns or habitat limitations and those kinds of things. They get more detailed than our statewide plan. It's probably important to note that these Bighorn Sheep Unit Management Plans prior to now have not been taken through the rack and board process. They weren't even public documents. We used them internally in the DWR to guide management decisions as far as transplants or hunting or habitat work, things like that. But we thought it was important that we bring them through the rack and board as, you know, a way to increase transparency, to get feedback from Utah's public, from the constituencies, the interest groups. And so that's really what we're here to do. It's not something that's in our statute that we need to do, but we recognize this is a good opportunity to bring it through the racks and boards, get feedback, and so we're excited for that. Once these plans are approved by the racks and the board, after that they won't be brought back to you to be presented unless there is a significant boundary change, a change in the population objective, or there's a new bighorn sheep unit that's being proposed. Any other changes that are made to these unit plans will be approved by the division's director. So as I mentioned, the unit plans get into more details of the specifics for the areas. There are a total of 19 bighorn sheep management units, and 18 of those will be presented today and available for the vote and for the comment and for the vote. The one that will not be presented is for the Mineral Mountains. That was presented in May of 2018 and approved by the RAC and boards, or the RACs and the board. And that management plan, because it was done recently and there's nothing in that plan that conflicts with the statewide plan, we won't be presenting that. But the rest of them have not been taken through before, and so they'll be available today. Of these 18, 11 of them are for Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, which we have in the northern half of the state, and then 7 of them are for desert bighorn sheep. And then inside of these units, some of you recognize there are subunits as well, which the unit management plans talk about. Even though these plans go into the specifics about the unit, they do maintain or reflect the overall goals of the statewide plan. So I thought maybe it'd be good to talk about a couple of those things that are important in the statewide plan that are included in the unit management plans. So the DWR's objective, overall objective, is to expand bighorn sheep populations where feasible to maintain bighorn sheep on a sustainable statewide basis. Another important facet is that the DWR will not manage bighorn sheep to the involuntary exclusion of domestic sheep. This includes recognizing that the state accepts the risk of any of these bighorn sheep herds and recognizes that, you know, that they will go through difficulties, that there'll be hurdles that they'll have to go through. And if those bighorn sheep herds are unsuccessful, that's on the state, the DWR. And then also the DWR's goal is to manage for healthy populations of bighorn sheep that provide quality opportunities for hunting and viewing. So those are some of the overarching objectives. Well, now we'll kind of dive into some of the more specific stuff about each of these unit management plans. Each of the unit management plans contain a population goal and objective, and that is the number of animals that we hope to have on those units. And that number of animals is something that can change depending on the habitat that is available. And so some of the things that influence how much available habitat is available have to do with human development, fires. Sometimes fires can open up more habitat for bighorn sheep. Also, water availability, that's water, drinking water, that can, you know, come and go as we develop guzzlers and things of that nature. And then also the risk of pathogen transmission. We'll dive a little bit more into that in a minute. But pathogens and diseases that plague bighorn sheep can be an important part into where we come up with our population objectives. The statewide population objective, as a sum of these plans that are being presented, including the minerals, is 9,025. The current estimate of abundance or population estimate in the state is 4,150. This is what that looks like graphically. See the red line there is that objective for the statewide. And the blue line that's increased over the last 20 years, generally increased, I should say, is the abundance, the estimated number of animals in the state. So you can see that we're definitely not at the objective, but you know, some good things is that in the last 20 years or so, we've been able to double bighorn sheep populations in the state. Each of those units on this slide are laid out in this table. And there's a couple columns here, and I'll take a minute to talk through this to make sure it's clear. The objective is the population objective that is in, you'll find in those unit management plans for each of the units. And then the abundance is the current estimate of the number of animals in that unit. So as you look through here, there's a couple things that are probably important. You see the number 125 on a number of those as the objective for a number of those units, like Antelope Island, Nebo, Pilot Mountains, and then some others. That number 125 is what we recognize as being a minimal viable population. It's a number that we try to strive for, to have at least that many animals, and that helps us avoid things like inbreeding. And so from a genetic diversity standpoint, we feel that 125 is the minimum number that we manage for. Another thing that you'll notice here is that most of these units are well below the objective. That means that the current estimated number of animals is well below the objective. And that most of those units are struggling with respiratory disease. Those numbers, we manage for those as best that we can, and as opportunities become available to increase and to try to meet that objective, we do so. The population objectives that you see here the same population objectives that we have had for these units, you know, in recent past as they've been established. As I mentioned, these documents have been internal. Those are the same numbers that we've had for those units for a number of years. The only one that has a significant increase from what we've managed for in the recent past, as to what you're seeing here, is for the Stansbury, it's the Ochre Stansbury West. So on here you see that's the Stansbury Mountains. That objective is 500. In the past, that's been 375. We filled that with some of the recent fire history and some of our efforts to spread bighorn sheep across that unit. We feel that that's an appropriate number. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of those you saw that are well below their objective struggle with respiratory disease. Respiratory disease is the most common limiting factor to these units reaching their population objective. And so in each of the unit plans, it dives into some of the tools, some of the techniques that we'll use to try to address that or to mitigate the risk of respiratory disease. Spatial and or temporal separation, that's separation from animals that we believe have a likelihood of carrying the pathogens that cause respiratory disease. Also employing emerging technologies that help us treat herds that that suffer from respiratory disease. And then also, one of the things that we are interested in is win-win agreements or situations where changes to grazing practices that are voluntary that benefit bighorn sheep. We also believe it's important to remove bighorns or stray domestics that pose threats of risk of transmission, that pose threat of transmission, and then also manage the density, the sex ratios, and the age structure of these herds to minimize the risk of pathogen transmission. And then also for all of our units, we have a rotational basis where we go through and we sample the animals in those herds so that we have a current understanding of what pathogens exist there and how to manage those. Another one of the specifics that these unit management plans go over are habitat objectives. Overall, it's important that we maintain and improve bighorn sheep habitat to enhance individual herd success. And so then these unit plans go into specific canyons, drainages, guzzlers, where we can do water improvements, where fire could be managed to improve bighorn habitat, and how that in different areas where we have efforts that will improve spatial and temporal separation. Another one of the specifics is recreation objectives. Overall, it's important that we increase public awareness and education while working to expand opportunities to view bighorn sheep, as well as opportunities to hunt them. And so we are striving to increase hunting opportunities as populations allow while maintaining quality hunting experiences. All of these unit management plans follow the statewide plan wherein the DWR offers or recommends permits based on 12 to 25% of the animals that are counted during our surveys, the rams that are counted in the surveys, or 30 to 60% of the rams that are 6 years or older. And then on different units, it's encouraged or discussed how we'll explore hunts with variable season lengths, dates, and weapon types. And then also exploring female-only hunts. And those are needed to address density concerns or population concerns when we're coming up against our population objective. And that's everything that I have. Thanks for your time. I'd be happy to hear input.
Questions for Jace from the RAC. Mike.
And then, Jace, as I look through your the specific plans for each unit, some units had like 110 rams for 100 ewes. Is that during various counts? Is that a viable thing that the division strives for, or what? Tell me about that herd dynamic.
Yeah, so one of the things what Mike's talking about, in many of the unit management plans, they'll have the data from the past surveys, so these flight surveys, right? Mm-hmm. So you can go back and you can say, okay, it was flown in 2017, 2015, 2014, whatever it is. And in there we list the number of animals we counted and then a ram to ewe ratio, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what Mike's talking about. And some of those, sometimes we do a flight and we count more rams than we do ewes. And so we would estimate that there are 110 rams per 100 ewes. That is not something that we manage for, that we strive for. We definitely try to keep that number close. Most times we try to keep it something anywhere from 30 to 60 rams per 100 ewes, especially in our hunted populations. There could be a number of reasons why that happens on surveys. Maybe it's just an outlier just that happens that day. And I don't think that you see, as you look through those, happen often and doesn't happen in the same units repeatedly. It's more just outliers, I think.
If it's real, how does that happen, Jace? Because rams have a lower lifespan, shorter lifespan than ewes. Are the females more susceptible to disease, or
No, I don't think so. So the question is, how does it happen that we get ram more rams than used in a population? Yeah. I think that that's really just an artifact of the survey, to be in my opinion. I think that one day you happen to catch a big group of rams on your survey, and you might miss some ewes. I don't think that, that many of the populations are actually, you know, maintaining more rams than ewes. I think that's just an artifact of the variability of the flight.
And kind of sightability at the time.
Sightability that day, yeah.
And I understand that 110 to 100 isn't, that's just the ratio. Like, many units don't even have 100 sheep on them, so.
Exactly.
Eric, did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, in there you mentioned removal of domestic, the stray, you know, those that get left behind on food maternity. How is that being done from the division standpoint where it's a private animal?
Sure. So we have a policy in place, or a guideline, I should say, that we've worked through with the Department of Ag, that we have an agreement that's signed. What happens basically is if a domestic animal is seen in a place where we have bighorn sheep, maybe it's been left behind or it's wandered off of the allotment or the private property, that we'll contact the county sheriff's office, and we work with the county sheriff's office, and ultimately the decision making lies with them, and then we decide whether it's appropriate to remove that animal lethally, or, you know, try to alive, and then, you know, contact and trying to find out whose it is, contacting it, and then compensating if it is removed lethally. Yeah, there's a guideline, and I can help you. I can send that to you if you like to.
I have a question. I read recently that Colorado's sheep population in dinosaur tested positive for pneumonia, like 100%. Could you talk about maybe Utah's sheep population in that area and just the status and the viability of those sheep in and around dinosaur?
Up and around dinosaur? So maybe I could help. I do have maps here that go through each of these unit plans. We'll get here to our Uinta Mountains plan. So here you see our Uinta Mountains plan, and it's broken up. It's kind of hard to see there, but the suitable bighorn habitat is kind of that orangish color, and then the crosshatch stuff is where bighorn sheep are currently occupying. And if you see down here towards the border down there by that 9D, 9C kind of area, you see that strip of occupied habitat that comes into Utah. That's dinosaur right there, right? So the herd there, like you talk about, we communicate with parks, national parks, and we understand, you know, as best we can the status of there. And they do contain pathogens that cause respiratory disease. So we don't have connectivity from dinosaur into the bighorn herd that we have there. You see up by, like, Flaming Gorge or going up into the High Uintas and stuff like that. We don't have connectivity that we know of on a regular basis through there. But that bighorn herd there in Uintas also does have similar pathogens, maybe not the exact same ones, yeah, but similar ones that do cause respiratory disease.
Are many sheep wandering out of dinosaur onto state and federal lands in Utah?
That's a good question. I wish, you know, had someone from parks or even from the region here to address that specifically. I don't believe so. At least not far enough that they're coming in contact with our bighorns. I can speak to that. Mm-hmm. Outside of the park, I wish I could give you a great answer, but I can't.
I just wondered if, you know, because it's tested positive, that would be rationale for increasing quotas in that area.
So they don't hunt bighorns inside the park itself.
Right, the ones who wander.
And then for ours on our area. Yeah, I mean, that would be, you know, yeah, understandable rationale. I think that with this herd, there are other more imminent or more pertinent risks of contact than the bighorn, the wild bighorns that are in dinosaur. It's a good question.
Jace, of the 4,100 sheep that we have, how many are sick?
Yeah, so of the 4,100 that we have in the state, the vast majority of those have the pathogens that can cause respiratory disease. Yeah, that's a good question. The only herds that we have that do not contain those pathogens are the Newfoundland Mountains, the Stansberry Mountains, the Oak Creek Mountains, and then a portion of the Pine Valley. So, I mean, the vast majority of them.
What are your plans for Antelope Island?
Yeah, Antelope Island. So Antelope Island experienced a disease event starting last November, and then we decided that it would be best to depopulate the island, lethally remove all the bighorns that were there, and start over. The depopulation has gone well. It's been a hard and, you know, a sad process, but as far as successfully removing the animals, we've been very successful that way. And we have plans to reintroduce bighorn sheep in January of 2020. If everything goes well, that's assuming that, you know, we continue to see that the depopulation has gone well and that the source herds are suitable, healthy, to bring.
Jace, looking at the population data, maybe it would best describe these as very volatile, every one of them. Either the survey numbers change every 3 years pretty dramatically, or the actual population numbers change pretty dramatically every 3 years. It was, on a few cases, you could see as much as a 50% population change from survey to survey, and that was probably the exception, but 20 to 30% seemed to be the norm, a bump or a decline. So I'm just wondering about hunter opportunity. If you're going to lose potentially 30% of your animals in any particular year, why are we limiting harvest to so few?
Sure, that's a good question. So those guidelines, the 12 to 25% of the counted rams or the 30 to 60% of counted rams, those were approved with the statewide plan. And there was a good, I feel like there was a good representation from sportsmen and from other groups to come to a conclusion on those numbers. Those numbers have increased recently. Before this statewide plan was approved back in November, it was 12 to 15% and then 30 to 40% of the older rams. So I think we've made a great stride to be able to increase more opportunity for the exact reasoning that you have right there, Scott. And I think it's good reasoning. If you look at those percentage guidelines, that's also one of the more aggressive guidelines that you have in Western states. Traditionally, just bighorn sheep have really been hunted very conservatively. And I think it has to do with the fact that there were so few of them at one time, and then bringing all the effort and money that went into bringing them back. And just people really want to hold tight to what they have and let them get as big as possible. And I think that there's definitely a lot of that kind of sentiment. But your mentality is, we have seen a shift more towards your mentality, and we're making efforts to offer more opportunity. That's the best, you know, answer I can give.
Okay. Ben? I just want to add to what Jay said a little bit. I had the opportunity to sit on that Bighorn Sheep Committee last year, and those changes that he mentioned, the amount of tags that we can offer now are much more liberal than they were prior to this current plan, which was just adopted this last fall. That sentiment, the desire to increase tags as much as possible, was felt and expressed across the entire committee without any reservations. So this is definitely an improvement from where we've been.
It makes a difference for a sportsman's opportunity, but it also makes a difference for some of our tools that we use to manage, you know, risk as well. Having lower densities, having younger ram structures, those kind of things can help. I can say from the 2018 permits that were offered to the 2019 permits, so right in there is where we made the change. We had like a 30% increase in Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep permits and a 20-25% increase in the desert bighorn sheep permits. So we are shifting, I think.
So is there any thought about offering ewe permits? Is there any value in that? Or
yeah,
because
definitely.
Our populations are so low, is that still viewed as a risk?
Absolutely. So if you look here, you can see the objective and the abundance. Well, the only one of the units right now that we have that's approaching its objective is the Newfoundland Mountains, where the objective is 350, and the last estimate from last year was 310. And yeah, in that situation specifically, we are considering ewe hunts and other places too, but you know, most of them aren't coming up against their objective.
That Newfoundland Mountain population is disease-free or not disease-free?
Disease-free.
It is disease-free. So it would serve as a transplant population as well.
Yeah, it's one of those that came from Antelope Island. It's done really, really well. It's grown ever since we put it there. And we've actually removed quite a few animals from the Newfoundland Mountains to start other places like the Oak Creeks, and then also on the Stansberries, captured them and moved them off. So
I didn't really see much in the plan about additional areas that you're evaluating for release. Are there still locations outside of these units? Within the units, it kind of mentioned that, but outside of these units, is there still bighorn habitat that's being looked at?
Yeah, so you're right. Inside of the unit plans, it only talks about locations within the units, right? The statewide plan does list other potential release sites that are outside of our current units. So if you want to see kind of that kind of list, jump on the statewide plan. Yeah, there are places that that we're pursuing. They all need, you know, varying degrees of work to make them more suitable before we can release Bighorn there. But yeah, we are pursuing a number of them.
Okay. One more question. So in the Uintas, on the western portion in the Uintas, there's not a viable herd there. What is the reasoning for not transplanting and using that habitat?
So you're talking about west. So right now the herd as far west as it goes about Gilbert Peak.
Mm-hmm.
And they winter down like Hoop Lake.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so they'll move back and forth between there. So going west from there, there are active Forest Service domestic sheep grazing.
Sheep allotments, okay.
So it's probably not in our best interest to do that right now.
Thank you. Questions from the public?
Travis Jensen, Utah Wild Sheep Foundation. Jace, can you expand a little bit on your thoughts in respect to causal factors for the die-off on Antelope Island?
Yeah, I can go a little bit. So prior to November, the Antelope Island bighorn sheep population had been tested pretty regularly for pathogens because we're moving bighorns off of there. Most recently, in January 2018, we had moved bighorn off there to go to Stansbury Island or Stansbury Mountains as well as the Oak Creek Mountains. And in all that testing prior to, up until that time, we had never picked up specific pathogens that we worry most about causing respiratory disease. When they started having the die-off in November, we went out and sampled a number of animals, and we found those pathogens that usually, coincide with the respiratory disease. So somehow or other, the pathogens had made it to Antelope Island. Those specific pathogens are only transferred or mostly transferred from physical contact with other wildlife that carry those pathogens, most often other bighorn sheep or domestic sheep or goats. And so somehow or other, either an animal carrying the pathogen came to Antelope Island or a bighorn from Antelope Island came off, contracted the pathogen, and came back with it. And then from there it spread. We're never probably ever going to know for sure how the pathogen made it there, but that's, from what we understand in the science, that contact must have been made at some point. There are domestic sheep and goats off the south end of Antelope Island on private property, which everyone's right. The nearest wild bighorn sheep that carry the pathogens would be quite a ways away here, actually, probably. So it's unlikely that they came in contact with other wild bighorn sheep.
What are you going to do to curtail that in the future?
Yeah, so some things we can do to kind of prevent this from happening in the future. There's a fence being built on the south end of Antelope Island. It's actually being built on the state park by the state parks on the state parks property, a wildlife fence, an 8-foot fence that should hopefully keep bighorn from leaving or other animals from coming to the island. Also, we're trying to work with some of the private property owners, again in voluntary situations, that'll hopefully help reduce the risk. And then also one of the things that Travis's. One of the things that we believe may play a factor in bighorn sheep leaving the Antelope Island is ram densities. We believe that the higher density that you have of rams in an area, the more incentive there is for some of those rams to try to leave because there are fewer breeding opportunities for them on Antelope Island. And so we're hoping that going forward we'll be able to manage for a lower ram to ewe ratio and lower ram densities, hopefully even younger ram age structure. So that's something that we hope to be able to do going forward that we're trying to work with the parks on.
That's what I was just going to say. Is state parks open to that?
We've had conversations. There's a lot of hoops that we'd have to jump through and details, but they, the state parks folks, their biologists, their management, at least in Antelope Island State Park, has been great. They understand the biology, the ecology of it, and they've been great to work with, and hopefully we can find a situation that moves forward. That might mean different hunting, it might mean different transplants, something like that. But yeah, they've been good to work with.
I have two questions there. Yeah. Can you take pack goats onto the island, number one? And number two, what's being done? I've talked to a whole bunch of hunters that are starting to raise pack goats to take on their hunts, and how's that going to influence
sheep in areas where they don't have disease?
Good questions. So first one for Antelope Island, there are restrictions in place that keep people from bringing domestic sheep or goats to Antelope Island State Park. One thing that we're hoping to be able to do moving forward that'll hopefully reduce the risk of that happening is trying to increase some signage. We're working with the state parks that way. But that's always been a standing restriction. But as far as pack goats go, it is becoming much more popular for hunters or even just backpackers to use goats as a pack animal, much like you would a horse, to go and to hunt or to recreate. I think that the efforts that we're trying to make right now is that we're trying to figure out how and where we can work with land management agencies to, if there's trails where we can have restrictions for those types of animals, where that makes sense. And then also, mostly we need to work with those agencies, that enforcement. But it's a great question because it is becoming much more popular. Something that we have thought about that we look to spend more time and effort on.
You had a question?
My name is McKinley Smoot. I just had a question. Do mountain goats, do they, I don't know if they get in contact with each other, and do they contain the same pathogens for respiratory diseases as the bighorn sheep in Utah populations?
That's a good question. So, yes, there are places where we have overlap occupied habitat of mountain goats and bighorn sheep. And to answer the question, yes, these pathogens that we've talked about, some of the specific ones that we're concerned about, can be carried by domestic sheep and goats, also wild sheep and wild goats as well, to answer your question. I think that we have a few places where that's the case, where there's potential for that, I should say.
So I think we've had our DR. So we'll have public comments. I have several cards here. Let's start with Wade Garrett.
You're coming first.
You're on top, buddy.
I wanted to hear what Travis had to say before I said anything. So,
say your name and who you represent, please.
Jeez. I'm Wade Garrett, Utah Farm Bureau. Appreciate the opportunity. So we had a few concerns this morning, talked with Justin, Jace, Ben, and just appreciate the transparency and the willingness of the division to help us and go through that. And I think if we can work together, we can get a more sustainable sheep population with agriculture and be more open and make sure we're not going into sheep areas and vice versa, and work on seeing if we can make these more sustainable. So thank you.
You bet. Travis Jensen.
My name is Travis Jensen. I am representing the Utah Wild Sheep Foundation and also a sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. I'd like to thank the committee for the discussion. I'd also like to thank the DWR and Jace and the regional biologists. I think they've done a great job putting together these regional management plans. I was also a part of the committee that put together the statewide management plan. I think there was some great progress made there between agriculture and multiple other groups to make compromise in those plans. The statewide plan and the reflection in these unit management plans. I think the one concern and the question that I had in respect to Antelope Island and the disease event there, that discussion went down the road that I wanted it to, because the structure of ram to ewe ratios does impact these animals and their propensity to wander, and that's what is the result of these disease events, is wandering animals. And it is a concern of mine that the limited harvest on Antelope Island is really holding the division back in their effective management of the island. There are additional permits that have been approved for the island, and I would like to see the division continue to pursue their efforts to get the state parks to at least increase the harvest objective on the island to try to offset some of the disease events associated, or the risk associated with a skewed ram to ewe population. And we are in support of these unit management plans, both Utah Wild Sheep Foundation and SFW. Thank you.
Thank you very much. McKinley Smoot.
I'm McKinley Smoot. I was raised on a cattle ranch at the base of the Uinta Mountains. We got about 550 acres up there. And one of the main concerns that I have, well, first of all, I am for any large animal population growth in the state, whatever it be, and it's native and proper for the land. However, it is important to me that these animals and also domestic animals, whether they be on BLM land or Forest Service or whatever it be, that they are moved properly, and for these wild animals that they have natural predation so far that that doesn't wipe out the populations and human predation. So this is basically just a general comment, and also with domestic animals that we can keep them involved as well, because our natural vegetation and soils have evolved over time with crazy animals. And so I think the more sheep we have, bighorn sheep, goats, and to be able to do that sustainably. So basically what I'm saying is I'm for this if we can do it sustainably. And thanks.
Thank you very much. Here's DWR clarification. Is there anything you want to comment on, Jace?
No, I'll just appreciate McKinley, Wade, and Travis for the comments.
Excellent. Comments from the RAC?
Not really a comment, but everything seemed to be positive with what the division wanted to do, so I would propose that we accept as presented.
So, Ben, you second? So, Ken is... made a motion that we accept as presented, and Ben has seconded that motion. Any discussion? All in favor? Unanimous. I don't have any other items on the agenda. Is there any opposition to adjourning? I get to use this new gavel they just gave me. Adjourned.